Welcome back to another deep dive. Today we are sitting up and stepping directly onto a battlefield. But we aren't talking about tanks or trenches or anything like that. We're talking about the invisible war happening right behind your screen, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It really is a war zone.
Yeah.
It's just one made entirely of code and, well, psychology.
And looking at the stack of notes and research we have in front of us, it's honestly a little terrifying. We aren't just talking about sophisticated algorithms here. We're talking about psychological manipulation, literal zombie armies of computers, and the laws that are trying, sometimes desperately, to keep order in what feels like a digital Wild West.
That's a great way to frame it. The sources we're looking at today are very comprehensive. We're going to cover the absolute fundamentals of IT security. So we're looking at the psychology of the people trying to break in, the specific weapons they use, the malware, and then, you know, the physical and legal shields we have to protect ourselves.
Right. And the mission for this deep dive is pretty specific, isn't it? We want to move you from being just a passive user of technology, someone who just clicks remind me later on those updates and, you know, hopes for the best. We want you to become an informed digital citizen, to understand the why behind those annoying password prompts and all the strict workplace rules.
Exactly. It's about understanding the ecosystem you live in so you aren't just a sitting duck.
I have to admit, looking through these notes, the term that immediately jumped out at me was zombie devices.
Mm.
I mean, it sounds like something out of a B movie, not a computer science textbook.
It does, doesn't it? But it's a very real, very technical concept. We'll definitely get to the zombies. But for me, what's really fascinating in this research is it's the gray area. We often think of cybersecurity as black and white, good guys versus bad guys. But the sources highlight this really murky middle ground of hacker ethics and the surprisingly physical nature of data.
Physical nature? You mean like smashing things?
Sometimes. I mean, did you know that to truly delete data from certain hard drives, just hitting delete isn't enough? You basically need a giant industrial strength magnet to scramble the physics of the drive itself.
See, I thought dragging it to the trash bin was enough. Clearly, I have a lot to learn. Okay,
yes.
Let's unpack this properly. Let's start with the players on the field, the hackers.
The human element.
Mm.
Right. Now, when I think of a hacker, I picture the stereotype. You know the one. A guy in a hoodie in a dark basement, green code reflecting on his glasses, typing furiously.
Break into the Pentagon, yeah.
Exactly. But the reality is a bit more nuanced, isn't it? The source material breaks them down into three color-coded categories.
It uses the hat terminology, which actually comes from old Westerns. Bad guys wore black hats, good guys wore white. So, starting with the villains, you have your black hat hackers.
And these are the ones fitting the stereotype.
Largely, yes. Their defining characteristic is malicious intent. They are trying to gain unauthorized access to computer systems, to networks. Their goals are usually theft, stealing credit card info, corporate secrets, or just causing damage for the sake of it.
And the notes mentioned they often work for organized crime rings.
That's a huge part of it now. It's a business. This isn't just mischief anymore. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. They steal data to sell it. This is the strictly illegal side.
Okay, so that's the clear bad guy. Then on the flip side, we have the white hat hackers.
The white hats. These are the ethical hackers. Now, here's the interesting thing. They use the exact same tools and techniques as the black hats. They're just as skilled. They run the same code.
So what makes them the good guys?
One word. Permission. White hat hackers try to find vulnerabilities in systems, but they have the owner's explicit agreement to do it. Companies actually hire them, essentially as digital security guards, to break into their own systems, find the weak spots, and report them so they can be fixed before a black hat finds them.
So they're hired guns, but legal ones.
Precisely. It's legal because of that authorization.
Okay, so black hat is bad and illegal. White hat is good and legal. But then there's this third category. The gray hat hacker. This is where it gets really interesting to me and, frankly, a little confusing.
It is the most complex one, yeah. Emotionally and legally. Gray hat hackers are, well, they're walking a fine line. Like black hats, they're trying to gain access to systems. But like white hats, they often don't have malicious intent. They might just be doing it for the intellectual challenge, or maybe they just enjoy the thrill of discovering vulnerabilities.
So they aren't trying to steal your bank details or crash your server.
Generally, no. They usually don't exploit the vulnerabilities they find. They might even email the company afterwards and say, hey, I found a hole in your wall. You should probably patch that.
That sounds helpful. I mean, if someone told me my front door was unlocked, I'd say, thank you. Why is this considered gray?
Because, and if you take nothing else away from this segment, take this. They do not have permission.
And that's the deal breaker.
That is the deal breaker. Even if you break into a system just to prove you can, or even if you break in to leave a helpful note, the act of hacking without permission is illegal. The law doesn't necessarily look at your intent to be nice. It looks at your lack of authorization.
That is a huge aha moment for me. The defining line between legal and illegal isn't just being mean, it's having an invitation.
Think of it this way. You can't pick the lock on your neighbor's front door and walk into their living room, even if your only intention was to leave a note saying, your lock is easy to pick. You're still breaking and entering.
That really puts it in perspective. You can't just vigilante your way through other people's servers. Okay, so we know who they are. Now let's talk about their weapons, the arsenal of threats. How do they actually get in? The notes mention something called a denial of service, or DOS attack.
A DOS attack is. It's a brute force method. Not subtle at all. Imagine a server, like the computer hosting a website, is like a shop with one front door.
Okay, I'm picturing a shop.
A DOS attack is like sending 1,000 people to crowd that door all at once. They aren't going to buy anything. They're just standing there, jamming the entryway.
So legitimate customers, the real traffic, can't get in.
Exactly. The server spends so much time trying to process these fake requests or just dealing with the traffic jam that it either crashes or becomes completely unusable for the real users.
It's a digital blockade.
Precisely.
And then we get to malware. The sources list quite a few flavors here. I feel like in pop culture, people use terms like virus and worm interchangeably, but looking at these notes, they are actually mechanically different.
Well, they're very different. And the distinction really matters for how you treat them. Malware is just the umbrella term for malicious software. But let's take viruses versus worms.
Help me out here. What is the actual technical difference?
Okay, so a virus is a program that attaches itself to a file or a document. Mm. But the key mechanism is that it needs you, the user, to do something. It replicates by tricking you into running it or opening that infected file. It needs a host to travel.
Okay, so a virus needs me to make a mistake. It needs a ride.
Right, but a worm is much scarier. A worm is standalone software. It doesn't need a host file. And importantly, it doesn't need you to click anything.
So how does it move?
It crawls through the network all on its own. It scans for vulnerabilities in the operating system, exploits them, copies itself to the new machine, and then just repeats. It can spread exponentially without any human intervention.
That is terrifying. It's like an autonomous weapon.
Effectively, yes. Then you have Trojans, named after the Trojan horse, of course.
Hiding inside the GIF.
Exactly. It hides inside what looks like standard, legitimate software. You download a game or a helpful utility tool, but hidden inside the code is a malicious payload. Once you install the gift, the Trojan opens a back door into your system.
And once that door is open, that's when the really nasty stuff can walk in.
Correct. That back door is often used to deploy something like ransomware.
This is the one we hear about in the news constantly.
Because it's where the money is. Ransomware is digital kidnapping. It encrypts your data, locks it up mathematically, and then demands a fee, usually in cryptocurrency, to decrypt it.
And then there's the spy stuff. Spyware and adware.
Spyware is insidious. It runs quietly in the background, just watching and recording your activity, your keystrokes, websites you visit. It's trying to capture passwords or banking info. Adware is generally less dangerous, but incredibly annoying. It just floods you with intrusive pop-ups that are hard to turn off.
Now, earlier you teased the zombies. The notes mention botnets.
Right. This brings us back to that DOS attack we mentioned, the shop with the blocked door. How does one hacker get 1,000 computers to flood a server? They don't own 1,000 computers, they use yours.
Mine.
Well, maybe. If your computer is infected with certain malware, it can become part of a botnet, a robot network. The hacker controls it remotely without you knowing. Your computer becomes a zombie, mindlessly following orders to attack other targets while you're just trying to check your email.
So I could be unwittingly part of a cyber attack right now.
If your security isn't up to scratch, yes. You're providing the computing power for the villain.
Well, that's a cheerful thought. But you know, despite all this high-tech software, the part of the notes that I found the most relatable and honestly the most effective was social engineering.
Hacking the human.
Exactly. It's not about coding. It's about manipulation.
It's often the path of least resistance. I mean, why spend weeks trying to crack a sophisticated encryption code when I can just trick you into giving me the password?
The sources list a few types here. Phishing is the big one we all know. Those fake emails looking like they're from a bank.
Yep, trying to get you to click a link and enter sensitive data. But then look at baiting.
Baiting. That's offering a reward, right?
It appeals to greed or curiosity. click here for free Bitcoin, or download this movie for free.
Yeah.
You offer a reward that never arrives. The goal is just to get your info or get you to download malware.
Then there's quid pro quo.
Latin for something. In an attack, the hacker offers a service. For example, they might call you pretending to be from IT support.
Oh, I've had that call. Hello, we detected a virus on your Windows machine.
Exactly that one. They say, I can fix it for you. That's the benefit. But first, I need you to install this remote access software. That's the action you take.
Which, of course, gives them the keys to the kingdom.
Exactly. They prey on your helpfulness or your fear. And speaking of fear, there is scareware. You've probably seen this. A pop-up that screams, your computer is infected. Click here to fix. In flashing red letters.
Oh, yeah. My heart skips a beat every time, even though I know it's fake.
That panic is exactly what they're banking on. They want to bypass your logical brain and trigger that fight or flight response. You click in a panic, you download the malware.
And then there is the low-tech classic, shoulder surfing.
Literally just looking over someone's shoulder at an ATM or a keyboard.
It's almost embarrassingly simple.
But effective. You don't need code to steal a PIN. You just need eyes.
So we have these hackers, and they have this massive arsenal. What happens when they succeed? What's the actual impact?
The sources categorize the impact into three main areas. First, you've got data destruction. The data is just gone, deleted, a malicious wipe.
That sounds bad, but maybe recoverable.
Maybe, but the second one is often worse. Data modification. This is subtle. Imagine a hacker changing the figures in a bank account or altering the conclusion of a medical report.
You might not even notice until it's too late. You're making decisions based on lies.
Exactly. Trust is broken.
Right.
And third is identity theft. Using your personal info to pretend to be you, taking out loans, ordering stuff, it can ruin your credit and your life for years.
So how do we stop it? The notes cover prevention measures, and I like that it breaks them down into physical and logical. It starts with physical, because we forget that computers are actual objects in rooms.
We do. We live in the cloud, but the cloud is just servers in a building somewhere. Physical prevention is your first line of defense. This includes biometrics.
Fingerprints, facial recognition.
An eye scans iris or retina. These rely on unique physical characteristics. They're hard to fake. Not impossible, but hard. Then you have hardware tokens like RFID entry cards or just keypads on doors. It sounds mundane, but just locking the server room door is a critical cybersecurity measure.
And backups.
Crucial. But the notes specify secure backups. It's not enough to copy files to an external drive and leave it sitting next to the computer.
Because if the office burns down, you lose both.
Exactly. Or if a thief steals the PC, they steal the backup too. You need to store that data securely in a separate remote location.
Okay, so that's the physical stuff. What about the software shields, the logical prevention?
This is where we get the tools you see on your screen. Firewalls are the gatekeepers. They sit between your network and the internet, filtering packets of data. They check the ID of everything coming in and block anything that looks harmful.
And encryption.
Just scrambling the data. If I steal your file but it's encrypted, it looks like gibberish unless I have the key or password. It protects the data even if the device is stolen.
The notes also mention antivirus. But I want to spend a second on 2FA, two-factor authentication. We hear this everywhere. But the notes clarify what a factor actually is, and I think a lot of people get this wrong.
This is a really important concept. Security pros define three types of authentication factors. Something you are, something you have, and something you know.
Something you are would be biometrics.
Right, your fingerprint or your face. Something you know is your password. And something you have is a physical object like a key fob, a smart card, or your specific phone.
And 2FA means using two of them.
It means using two different types. That is the key distinction. If you have a password and then you have to answer a secret question.
That's just two things I know.
Exactly. That is not two-factor authentication. That's just two steps of the same factor. True 2FA requires a password, which is knowledge, plus a fingerprint, which is biological. Or a password plus a code sent to your phone, which is possession. It forces the hacker to steal two completely different types of things.
That makes so much more sense. Now, before we move to the legal side, there was one detail in secure destruction that surprised me. Degaussing.
Ah, yes. It sounds cool, doesn't it?
It sounds like science fiction. What is it?
It's a machine, a degausser, that generates a massive magnetic field. You put a hard drive in, and it just scrambles the magnetic patterns that store the data. It's a magnetic wipe.
So the data is on forever.
Completely. But the notes here point out a critical limitation. It only works on magnetic media.
Like old school spinning hard drives.
Right. It does absolutely nothing to solid state drives, SSDs, or USB flash drives, or CDs.
Why not? I thought magnets destroyed everything electronic.
Not quite. SSDs and flash drives don't use magnetism to store data. They use electrical charges. If you run a magnet over a USB drive, the data is still sitting there.